There is nothing new about bullying. It's been going on for a long time. Does that mean that we just throw up our hands and say, well, it's part of life, suck it up? No, that's not how we respond. And Nehemiah gives us a great example of this as we look at how he handled it when he was bullied. Stay tuned.
If your desire is to become spiritually stronger, emotionally healthier, and relationally smarter, you're at the right place. Speaker and writer Stephanie Smith inspires and equips you to achieve these three key aims. If you're a parent, you also learn how to raise empowered kids ready for adulthood. Let's get started.
Yes, my friend, we are still in the Old Testament book of Nehemiah, and yes, we are still in chapter 2. But we are going to wrap up chapter 2 today and move on to chapter 3 in next week's episode. Nehemiah, who is a high official in the cabinet of King Artaxerxes, the Persian ruler who was the largest empire, who ruled the largest empire at that time, has had this mission after God put it on his heart to go back and to see the city of Jerusalem rebuilt, the walls around Jerusalem rebuilt. If you haven't already read the story for yourself recently, or you haven't listened to previous podcast episodes since we started with this study into Nehemiah, I encourage you to do that. Where we pick up today is when Nehemiah has gathered the information for himself. He's gone around the city with just a few men at night so he can get all of the information that he needs when he sets out to accomplish this huge, monstrous task. And when he goes out with these few men to gather the last remaining bit of information that he needs, he does this in privacy, and then he puts together a strategy, and that is then when he comes and he gathers the people together to cast a vision. Have you ever been in a situation where you needed to cast a vision? Maybe it was with a child. Maybe it was with a team or a group or a business. Well, Nehemiah models for us beautifully how we can do this effectively. The first thing that we see is that Nehemiah understands he needs the cooperation of others. He doesn't have a goal, he has a desire. Now, I know I've been using the word goal, and I'll probably continue to use that. But it is important for us to understand the difference between what are desires and what are goals. Simply put, it's this. A desire is something that requires the cooperation of other people. A goal is something that I can't achieve on my own. I have a goal to write a book. Actually, I have several books that I either am working on or they are in line for me to work on. And while I have a desire to see a certain number of those books sell, I can only control whether or not I actually write a book. Now, how I approach marketing and all those other things has a direct impact on whether I actually sell those books or not. But at the end of the day, I will not be able to make anybody buy a book. Therefore, selling a certain number of copies of any book is a desire. It's not a goal because I don't control it all myself. And it's kind of easy for us to see that when we're talking about things like maybe writing a book or remodeling a room or something of that nature. But we do this same thing when it comes to our personal relationships. And this is where we do need to be careful. Because when we end up approaching personal relational desires like goals, we will always end up frustrated at some point or another. I cannot make it a goal to have a fantastic marriage because I can't control that all on my own. That requires the cooperation of someone else. What I can set as a goal is how I will show up in a marriage or any other relationship. We cannot set as goals that our children will grow up to adopt our faith, our value system, our hobbies, our interests, or anything else of that nature. We can have those as our deepest desires, but we can never treat those like goals because people have to make and do make their own choices. This isn't just a distinction on words. It's really a matter of how we approach life, because then it goes to our expectations of ourselves and our expectations of others. Now, it's been going around for quite a long time that the most important thing in any kind of relationship is communication. And I don't believe that. I think it might be number two or number three, but I do not think it's number one, because I think the number one comes down to our expectations. And this whole notion that we're not supposed to have any expectations in a relationship is just nonsense. Of course we have expectations. I do not expect that my husband is going to run around with other women. God has expectations of us. Now, we get the free will to decide whether we're going to align ourselves with those expectations or not. And then we make our choices. But this whole idea that it's all about just what we communicate, and we totally ignore, what are we actually communicating about? Well, when we really dig into it, we're always communicating about our expectations. And when we get down to that level, where we are willing to say aloud to ourselves or to someone else, this is what I expect, not in a demanding way, it brings a humility and a transparency that has the potential to lead to intimacy. But if we just stay at that communication level and we never really get down to what we're expecting, we will miss a huge way that we can grow personally and that we can grow in our relationships. One of the ways then that we can get from just communicating to really getting down to that more fundamental layer, which is talking about our expectations, is when we identify what are our desires and what are our goals, and we can see where we're probably treating some goals as desires and we're probably treating some desires as goals, and we've got to get those lined up appropriately. Well, Nehemiah knows he has a desire. If it's a goal, it's something he could go do himself. He does not have the capacity to go and rebuild all of Jerusalem's walls all by himself. He knows this is a desire. God has placed it on his heart, but he still needs the cooperation of other people. How does he handle this? How does he get these people on board with this monumental project that he has? This isn't some small thing that he's showing up with, like out of the blue. This is a huge task, not just physically, but it carries profound ramifications for the city and the Jewish people. One thing that we can see is that he shares the vision after he has a strategy. Ideas are not plans, and goals are not strategies. You know, sometimes we beat ourselves up, and if we're honest, maybe we might internally beat somebody else up, being critical of them, because we equate goals with strategies. We think that ideas and plans are the same thing, and they're not. And when we don't distinguish between those two in a very literal way, we will often end up not succeeding. And then we think it's because, well, we just weren't motivated. We didn't have enough willpower. We weren't serious. And we end up criticizing and condemning ourselves because we think, oh, I just didn't have enough willpower. I just didn't have enough want to. I guess that was the issue. Rather than recognizing that sometimes it's just a matter that we had a goal, we never had a strategy for that. Just because we have a sincere goal for something, or even if it's a desire, doesn't mean we're somehow going to have the intuitive knowledge about how to make that happen. And this is something we have to be careful of as parents, is that we don't expect that our kids, when we lay something out, here's what you need to go accomplish, that it just somehow comes with this automatic understanding of how that should be accomplished. You know, recently I had a goal. At least I started with a goal. I wanted to move a piano from one room into another. Well, therefore, I thought, I think I can do this. And I have these little moving dollies, and it's not the huge upright piano. It's not a grand piano. And so I'm thinking I can do this. And I get so far where I get one end of the piano picked up and I put it on one of those moving dollies, the one end of the piano on these moving dollies. And I do succeed in rolling the piano to a different part of the room. And that is when I realize I didn't really have a goal. I really had a desire because I was going to need someone else's assistance. And I did a lot of work to really come to the place of saying, I am not going to be able to do this on my own. Because as it turned out, there was just enough physics involved that picking up the other end of that piano, because the other side was now up just enough on this other toe dolly, shifted just enough of the weight of that piano down to that other end that was still on the floor, I could not lift it up. Well, sometimes we set out with what we think are goals, and then we get so far, or we get stuck, which is what I did, and then we realize we don't really have a goal, we have a desire, we need some help, and then we have to have a strategy. I had a goal, I didn't have a good strategy. Therefore, I was either going to need a new strategy, and that strategy turned out to be admitting I actually had a desire and I needed somebody else's assistance, which I eventually got, and we were able to move the piano. Well, Nehemiah first gets a strategy to go with this vision. And when he assembles the people to cast this vision, to say, hey, I have this project all of us can be involved in. I believe this is something that God has called me to lead the doing of, but I'm going to need all y'all on board. Yeah, that's a Southern thing. That means like everybody. And when he casts this vision, he does this in a way that we can see there are four specific steps into casting this vision. And this is what we can use when we are casting vision. Whether that is casting a vision to our kids about the kind of life, or maybe it's just the kind of morning we want to have. And we can use these same steps. So here they are. The first one is he appeals to the people emotionally. He says to them, Jerusalem, which was the spiritual, political, and cultural capital of the entire Jewish people, is in shambles. This isn't just a statement of a matter of fact. He is appealing to them emotionally. Hey, look, guys, this place, this revered place, this place that has such an important part of our history, it's part of our identity as a people. Look at this. It's in shambles. It's in ruins. This isn't a new statement of fact for them. I mean, for crying out loud, these people live there. They know this. But sometimes we get so used to knowing something that we forget the significance of it to us emotionally. This isn't just a statement of fact that they're like, oh, really? Gosh, we thought the city was in great shape. But now that you put it that way, we kind of see it's in ruins. No, 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 that's not what's going on here. It's a matter that he's calling them back to something that's they've just gotten so used to not facing, that he wants to pull that up out of their heart and to see that what has become the norm should not be the norm. They need to not accept the status quo. They need to see from a different perspective and to understand that what they've gotten so used to is not something to get used to. And he appeals to them emotionally. He doesn't blame them. He's not condemning them. He's not saying, why have you guys done something about this before? He's calling them to an emotional awareness that says, our beloved cultural, spiritual, political capital is in ruins. If you want to get people on board with something, especially if it's a hard task, you have to appeal to them emotionally. It cannot just be a matter of statements of fact. All right, what's he do number two? He provides a solution with an emotional appeal. Now, for speakers and writers, we call this felt need. If we're going to write a book, if we're going to prepare a message, and we actually want people to benefit from it, then we need to identify what's the felt need. What's the need that they are feeling that my book, my message is going to speak to, that's going to resonate with them? There's a very big difference in saying, I have something that I want to talk about, and I have a message that can help people. And Nehemiah recognizes the difference here. And so he says, come, let's build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. He doesn't just say, come on, let's build the wall of Jerusalem, end of statement. He gives them an emotional objective and an emotional appeal to why to do this. Why take away from what they're having to do in their everyday lives of existence to say, now on top of all of that, we're going to take on this other major task. And he gives them an emotional objective and appeal that we may no longer suffer derision. He doesn't say, let's rebuild the walls because it makes economic sense, or you know, I think it will give us all a feeling of satisfaction or accomplishment, or to give future generations a safe place to dwell. He appeals to the emotions of the people who will be doing the work, and that they will experience in very short order the effect of their work, the benefit of their work. This is something that is important for kids. Yes, we need to teach children that they can't go through life just expecting instant gratification. But there is also something to be said for having benefits that come in short enough order that are tied to their actions, that it's not just all, well, someday you're going to need to learn this because someday 4 or 10 years from now, you're going to go to college, or you're going to need to know this because 15 years from now, when you're a father, blah, blah, blah. Yes, we want to have those types of things, but not as the replacement for, or the only way that we have any appeal to big tasks that they need to be taking on today. And this is especially true as our kids get older into middle school and definitely into high school. Nehemiah knows the value of having an emotional appeal. This isn't emotional manipulation. That is not what he's doing here. Rather, he is aligning himself with the way that God has designed us. We're emotional people, male and female both. We're not just intellectuals. We're not just spiritual. We are also emotional people. And Nehemiah aligns the way that he's trying to lead these people with the way that God has designed us and them. Okay, what's the third thing he does? He addresses their fears. He is very well aware that they are going to be fearful of two things. Number one, they're going to be fearful and uncertain whether God is behind this or not. They don't want to risk God's wrath by taking on something that he hasn't called them to do. And the second fear is they don't want to risk the wrath of King Artaxerxes, who is going to either come after them militarily or give the surrounding nations permission to go after them militarily, because he perceives the rebuilding of this city as rebellion towards him. They know their history well enough to know that when kings perceive rebellion, they can end up coming in and decimating a people and a city. That's why Jerusalem is laying there in ruins, because years earlier, the people had continued to rebel, and finally, King Nebuchadnezzar II says, "That's it. I've had it. These people have done this long enough. I'm just going to go over. I'm going to lay siege to the city." And then when he wins, he all but destroys it. Not just tearing the walls down, but even burning parts of the city with fire. Also, just 13 years prior to that, Ezra the priest had been trying to lead a rebuilding of the city, not because he was rebelling or trying to encourage rebellion against King Artaxerxes, but the neighbors tattled on them. King Artaxerxes doesn't really dig into the matter. He just jumps to a conclusion. He makes an assumption, and then he sends a message back that says, "No, that's not acceptable. Stop building. And if you don't, I'm going to give permission to the neighbors around you to come in and to cause you to stop building by force." This is the very same king that Nehemiah now shows up and says, "Oh, no, 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 he's changed his mind. Now we have permission to build." Nehemiah respects that people are rightfully going to be concerned about this whole rebuilding vision of his, and he addresses their fear early on, and he goes through and he explains to them the circumstances and the words of the king, which clearly demonstrated God was in this. God was the one that allowed him to hear this news to begin with. God was the one who kept King Artaxerxes from saying, "Off with your head," when Nehemiah shows up in his presence one day and he's sad, which was an "off with your head" offense. And instead, not only does he keep his head and his job, the king grants him permission and supplies him with what he needs to go back and to complete this work. Nehemiah addresses the fears that people have. If you set out to accomplish something, you need to think ahead about what are the fears that people are going to have, and not to perceive fear or concern or doubt as being, "I'm not on board, I'm opposed to you, I'm here to derail you." There are legitimate concerns and fears that normally come along anytime somebody is talking about change, especially if it's big change, and mature people do not get thrown off by that. They don't take offense at it. Instead, they honor people's needs and they address the fears that they have. The fourth thing that he does, which is really smart, is he is prepared for the people to act then. He doesn't come to them and cast this vision and then say, after they're like, "Okay, we're on board, you've won us over." He doesn't say, "Awesome, great. I'm putting together a planning committee and we'll get back together in another 6 months when I've got a strategy. But great to know y'all are on board." No. What he does is he has already put together a plan and a strategy, and he capitalizes on the energy that the people have once they are on board with this vision. I understand that there are times you have to do some sort of vision casting, and then you have to do some planning. I get that there can be times for that. Sometimes, however, You have to be wise to say, that's probably not going to get us to where we're not going to end up creating a strategy. We're just going to end up creating chaos. And people are going to be so worried about what's going to happen. We're never going to even get to strategy. There's a time to be able to come in and have your strategy all put together to then address people's fears, lay out your strategy, give them hope, and then be ready to move and to act. And there's a certain energy and a momentum there, and you need to capitalize that and go with it. Those are four ways that Nehemiah casts a vision and gets people on board. Again, this applies whether you are in a C-suite position or if you are a mom at home and you're just trying to get your kids on board with how you're going to do life. It might just be for that morning. Maybe it's for an ongoing pattern, but you can follow these four steps. You can appeal to people emotionally, not to manipulate them, but to refresh in them and to renew in them what has maybe become a latent desire. Secondly, you provide a solution that has an emotional appeal to that. Third, address the fears and concerns, and don't be resentful when people have those. And fourth, be prepared to get people engaged and acting when they've got the energy and the motivation to do so. The very end of this chapter two, what we read about is when a couple of the people who are in surrounding nations, they hear about this and they start jeering and despising this vision. Now, they can't just go and attack Nehemiah and the Jewish people there for a couple of reasons. One is there is some economic interplay at work here, but the other thing is they're also under King Artaxerxes' rule. And so for them to go and attack somebody else in his kingdom that he's ruling over is equivalent to them attacking the king. While they want to just go over and put this all to an end, however, they can't. But what they can do is they can jeer and they can mock and they can deride and they can try to use their words to get Nehemiah and the people discouraged and off track. Nehemiah doesn't bite. He does not get distracted by the criticism and the threats. He responds with directness. Basically, what he says is, God's with us. This is his work. Mind your own business. He doesn't spend his time and energy trying to answer their threats and their accusations that they're just trying to rebel against the king. He doesn't get distracted and derailed by criticism and threats from people who do not have a vested interest in their success, but absolutely have a vested interest in their failure. It is one thing to pay attention to criticism that comes from people who are vested in your success, and another thing to get distracted by people who are invested in your failure. So consider the source when you're getting criticized. Don't just throw all criticism out, but look at the motivation. Do they have a proven track record of being on your side, of being on your team, of wanting to see you succeed? If they do, you might want to pay attention to their criticism. But if their track record is they don't want you to succeed, which had already been established here, then don't get derailed and distracted and discouraged by their criticism. All right, my friend, that's going to wrap up the second chapter of the book of Nehemiah. I hope that you are finding this beneficial. And more than that, I hope this is helping to inspire you to read and study the Bible for yourself. I do want to mention that all of the speaking topics that I have do come from a faith-based perspective. That doesn't mean they're just nothing but a whole list of Bible verses, but that is the perspective that I teach from. I believe that one of the ways that God reveals himself to us is in primarily through the truth of the Bible, but also through science, through knowledge that he reveals through creation, and that he reveals as we study not just the natural world, but we also study human beings and we see what makes them tick. So many of my messages, I also bring in research, especially those that I do on parenting. So I invite you to check out my website, stephaniepresents.com, and look at the speaking engagements that I do for women's groups as well as for parents. Remember this, you have an impact that is immeasurable, eternal, and irreplaceable. See you next time.
Thank you for listening. Visit the website, stephaniepresents.com, and sign up for High Impact to join the mission of building spiritually strong, emotionally healthy, and relationally smart women and families. You can also book Stephanie to speak at your event and check out additional resources. Together, we can invite and equip generations to engage fully in God's grand story.